Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Peter Carey, whose latest novel is The Chemistry of Tears. Earlier novels include Parrot and Olivier in America, His Illegal Self, The True History of the Kelly Gang. There are 14 books in all. Peter Carey was born and raised in Australia, lived for a time in London, lives in New York. Peter Carey, in reading various interviews, each time someone asks you the origins of the book, you tend to give a different answer. One version says that you were thinking about the BP oil spill. Another version says that you were thinking about engines. And another interview says you were thinking about the consequences of the Industrial Revolution.
I have given all of these different answers, and I've given more answers than that. And I was thinking, in a way, how stupid it is, you know, for the writer to sort of go into these things at all, because firstly, because they change, secondly, because it's very complex, and there are more, you know, reasons than that. And my wife reminded me the other day that I do say that this was a recent idea of mine. She said, well, that's garbage, because in fact you've been talking about that for 7 years. And I realized where I started, and this isn't where the book ends up, and this isn't what the book is about, in quotes, but I really started thinking about the internal combustion engine and the enormous damage it's ended up doing to the planet. And I was thinking of this in a complicated emotional way, because my father and my grandfather sold cars. And my daddy's great triumph in selling T-model Fords to dairy farmers was to get a model with a limited slip differential so he could go up the muddy hill, and at the top of the hill the dairy farmer would buy the car. So at the same time, we all know about global warming and the role of the car and all of these sort of things. So my first sort of thought was that if hostile space aliens wanted to destroy the planet, they could do no better thing than to give us the plans for the internal combustion engine and just come back 200 years later. And that is really where it started. And my wife reminded me, I made so many different attempts to write that sort of book. And one of them set where my father sold the cars to dairy farmers, which happens to be in an area where there are also oil deposits. And then I had a bit of a crack at Henry Ford, and so on and so on. And as I was thinking about all of these things, and I was thinking about engines, and I did start to think, not exactly, I wasn't thinking Industrial Revolution, I sort of discovered that later, but I was thinking of all that sort of amazing, bright invention of the late 18th century and the 19th century and the Industrial Revolution. And what an amazing species we are, really. And if you look at all of those things that people were inventing and how innocent it seems now in comparison to science and invention at the service of corporatism, one could at least imagine that it was a more disinterested sort of science and a science more interested in truth. So, and in thinking about those things, I came across this magical mechanical duck, an automaton, which had been made in the 18th century and was meant to simulate life. The duck turns into a swan in the book for particular reasons, because I started looking at this duck, and then I found a swan along the way.
Was the duck Vaucanson's duck?
Yes. And, you know, he was quite a serious... If you go to museums in Paris, you'll see... Is it the Jacquard knitting process? He invented really serious things, but his duck was a society piece. Rich ladies and gentlemen and aristocrats would go to drawing rooms to see this duck perform, and it would lift its feathers and preen and defecate. It would eat and defecate, which was its sort of slightly fraudulent aspect of it, because, of course, what was happening at one end was not the same as what was happening at the other. But yet it did address the business of what is life, and is the human a machine? Could we create life ourselves if we wish to?
How did you find the duck?
I can't really honestly remember. There's a time in when I'm thinking about books that I'm looking everywhere, and I'm reading, I'm in libraries, I'm buying books, I'm online. I don't know where I first found out about the duck.
This was before Parrot and Olivier was published. When you showed up for that interview, you mentioned the automaton. You mentioned the museum. And you mentioned science fiction. And in the end, the book is not science fiction.
Well, it's got a little bit of that. There is still that certain element of sort of aliens inventing the internal combustion engine, but the person who carries that idea is a relatively minor character who is not particularly stable. her character had to be like that to sort of carry that particular idea. But the other thing, Richard, that was so weird in looking at these 19th century scientists, like Humphrey Davies, for instance, who is revered as a great man of the 19th century, who invented the safety lamp, which prevented all those miners blowing themselves up underground. And so it was a very practical and scientific person. If you read his book of his, which I think is called Consolations of Travel, it's full of the weirdest stuff. This is an acid-tripping scientist. So there are visions which... I have a slightly crazy German clockmaker called Sumper who believes all sorts of strange things. You look at Sumper, and a lot of Sumper's beliefs, really are fed by Humphrey Davies, the great British scientist.
Well, a crazier guy named Cruikshank, who is his mentor.
And, of course, Cruikshank, the craziness. Cruikshank, the machine that Cruikshank is building, is really a machine based on one by Charles Babbage, who invented the first computer ever made, the difference engine. He programmed the engine. So what he would do is have people sitting around in a drawing room, and he'd get them to add 2 to 2 and turn the handle on the machine and go 4. And the next person, they add 2 to it, and it'd get 6. And of course, after a while, it was a nice trick and it was an interesting machine, but after a while they all got bored, but he insisted on them keeping on doing it. And they got to a certain stage, and the answer was 171. And they said, it's wrong. He said, no, it's not wrong at all. I programmed it to do that, so that at the end of so many turns, it would do that. It's a computer mind, but it's also a sort of a mind that's addressing things like miracles as well. You don't see this as a miracle because you just as a miracle, but whoever programmed that knew it was going to happen.
Peter Carey, the duck morphed into a swan because you began doing research and you discovered this magnificent, beautiful silver swan. When you saw the silver swan, you went, this is much cooler.
Well, it wasn't because the swan looked so amazing, although I couldn't see the duck at all. The only photographs of the poor duck was in such a sorry state. I think it was Goethe saw it and said it was completely a mess and a poor, bedraggled thing. And indeed, the mechanical duck appears to have lived less than a human life in terms of its length of life. No, it was really because finding the swan, there was a whole lot of information about the swan. The museum at Bowes in Durham in England had just recently completed a fantastic restoration of it, which they had recorded. In fact, they'd done the restoration publicly. They took 30 days or 40 or 50 days, whatever it was, and every day there was a diary account of all the work, so I could understand how that swan was built. So, you look at that. That's my pragmatism of getting information. The swan's better. But I love the idea of the duck. So I wasn't prepared to give up the duck. You see, here's the great benefit of all of this. One is, of course, the duck becomes a swan, which has a sort of a minor sort of interest. You then begin to think of, well, he goes to find the man and asks him to make the duck. The character, which is the man Sumper, the clockmaker, says fine and takes the money and then proceeds without telling his client to make a swan. And in doing that, you discover the character of Sumper. Yeah, he's like one of those pig-headed artists or somebody who's given a commission by a patron who knows better than the patron, and he's sort of full of himself and he's full of his own grandeur. I'm very fond of him, by the way, but in the switch between duck and swan, I discover or begin to discover the character of Sumper. So his pig-headedness and his grandiosity is something that I found very attractive.
What you have now is a story from the 1850s about an English man whose son is dying and goes to Germany to have a craftsperson build a duck, which is then a swan. That's only one of the narratives. The other narrative is about a woman named Catherine Gehrig in 2010 who was reconstructing the swan. How did she come about, and where in this process did she emerge?
Well, the first thing about it, very schematically, the one thing I did know is that if the automaton is in the center, I needed someone in the present age to be trying to put it back together, and I needed someone in the 19th century to commission it. And the person in the 19th century was going to leave an account of that which we could read, and which Catherine, or whom it will be Catherine, restoring it, will be able to read too. if someone is going to be restoring one of these things, they are almost certainly going to be working for a museum. So then you start after thinking about museums and how this sort of thing works. I knew nothing about museums much at the start, a little bit, not much. See, the danger of the interview, the danger of saying I did this because of this, is because I'm a really unreliable witness to my own efforts. The business of making a book and trying all these different alleyways and ways in and discarding, it's a mess. I mean, it's a fun mess or a frightening mess, but one can't always sort of draw a sort of a linear line. So I can't remember exactly how or exactly when or with what foreknowledge or calculation or intelligence I decided that Catherine would share with somebody I heard about the experience of having a long affair with a married man who she worked with, and the married man dies. The affair has been completely secret. She's grief-stricken. It's a serious, serious love affair. She cannot display her grief. She cannot go to the funeral. She is sort of locked into the horror of her own story. And in the case of the story, life story that I heard about, you know, there were all these things like going into the office computer trying to delete emails and get rid of emails that would later become clear to the, So I had this idea that Catherine, the person who would restore this one, would be in that situation. At the time that I think I had the idea, I don't know at what level of my consciousness I was aware that I was choosing a situation which would be very relevant to my book, because she's dealing with life and death, and then what she's got to do is put together a machine that simulates life. And in that connection, a lot of the richness of the book arrives, I believe.
But in talking to you in the past, and when we've been discussing these kind of matters, it seems for you, for a lot of writers, but for you in particular, a lot of this is just the serendipity of the writing process.
Well, it is serendipity, but the serendipity is exactly what it is. But on the other hand, you've got somebody who's madly, obsessively trying to solve a problem or to make connections, and so I will return again and again and again and again and again to a sort of site of inquiry, looking for things that are going to expand my thought or help me discover a new thought. So it is serendipitous, but I don't know, it continues to happen. People talk about creativity and all of that sort of thing, which is not a word I really like very much. I think I proceed by saying, if this is so, therefore it follows that this must be so. And in following the sort of the logic of characters and their actions and the ideas that you have, or I'm saying to myself, I want this to happen. What sort of person would really, in real life, really do a thing like that? Not just because you jerk, want them to, but because what deep reason would make a person perform that action? And what sort of history must that person have that they would do that?
Peter Carey, in putting together The Swan, do you think that right now, if you had the pieces, you could kind of put it together yourself?
I couldn't possibly do it. I went to some trouble to have people read, what I'd done. And the real horologist who did it, he said publicly that he thought that it was a bit more interesting than the real life of being a horologist. And I just couldn't tell whether he was referring to the drug use or not. But anyway, I think he thinks it's sort of okay. But I couldn't do it. But I could write it so that he, reading it, might think it's okay.
What were some of the side trips that you just couldn't incorporate? Do you remember at this point?
I think there were a lot of things that I just tightened up, the things that went on too long. There was a whole lot of stuff that was in the Black Forest, for instance, and there was stuff about Sumpa the Clockmaker's relationship with Carl's mother. And there were things that I had gone into in greater length, which in the end sort of just really got in the way of what was the story. So it's that sort of thing of just paring away and paring away. If you want to look at that part of the world that you could historically connect with alchemy, for instance, which I certainly gave up on.
There are hints of fairy tales, particularly when they go into that kind of feels like a cave-like place where they make these things.
Well, the minute you're in the Black Forest, I start off in Karlsruhe because that's where Carl Benz had such success with the internal combustion engine. And then when you start to look at that, well, if you're looking for a place to have an automaton made, the Black Forest with its clockmakers is very close. And once I move my characters into the Black Forest, by the time I have a character who's a fairy tale collector, such creatures did exist, then I'm sort of bound to be thinking about fairy tales. And some of that feeling, I wasn't really aware of doing it particularly, but the feeling of that part of the book having a very fairy tale sort of feeling to it is something that readers remark on a lot, so I guess it must be there.
You're listening to an interview with Peter Carey, whose latest novel is The Chemistry of Tears. Is there a town of Furtwangen?
Yes.
Have you ever been there?
No, but I sent it to my general publisher, the book. He knew Furtwangen and had been there, and he had a friend who was a farmer in Furtwangen, and they sort of looked at it and they thought it was fine. But, you know, there's a funny thing about going there and not going there. I do remember at the time of having written Parrot and Olivier in America, and part of that is set in Pennsylvania, where Olivier visits the Eastern State Penitentiary. I did a reading in Philadelphia, and after it, the woman who was taking me around from my appointments said, "This is fantastic. The Eastern State Penitentiary is just behind this auditorium." And she said, "Didn't you go there?" And I said, "No." "Well, we can go there now," she said. I said, "Well, actually, I really don't want to." And she got really angry with me. "How can you do that?" And this is somebody I'd known for over the years. "How can you do that?" "Well, I can do that because, really, I'm making an imaginary place. What I would see now in the year of 2000, and, you know, whatever it was then, 10, is not going to really help me imagine that situation in 1830.
There's a German playing card of the Karlsruhe. Kind of looks like a wheel. Is that a real playing card?
No, it's not a playing card. It is indeed an old engraving of the ancient town of Karlsruhe, and I certainly spent a lot of time looking at German playing cards. So I do know that, you know, this was not a ridiculous thing to have on the verso side of a playing card in Germany in that period.
What occurred to me in looking at that layout is that I kept thinking of Albert Speer. You know, you're talking 100 years later.
Yeah. Well, Albert Speer's Hitler's architect, a man who fascinated me for years. Years. I once wrote an awful short story based on him, but yes. The thing that I just sort of found magical and amazing was that here's this city which is going to become famous, you know, for the manufacture of Benz automobiles, and there it is hundreds of years earlier, magically made in the shape of a wheel. So that's why I couldn't resist putting it in.
Peter Carey, there's also a Jesus automaton. Is that just from your imagination? Because if it isn't, I want to know where it is.
Well, it's very funny. I thought I'd invented it, and it's a very irreligious Jesus automaton, but it came to me quite recently, well after the book was finished and published, that in fact that my son bought on the street in Brooklyn one day this dog that laughed, that rolled over and rolled over and rolled over, and it had a sort of a visual sensor. So if you walked past it, it saw you, it'd go into peals of laughter and roll over and roll over. And there was nobody who saw this thing who didn't laugh. And I used to put it in front of our front door, so when people came in, first thing that happened was his dog would roll around on the floor laughing. So I think that's a version of the dog. The Jesus does some of the things the dog does.
The Silver Swan itself, if anyone is interested in seeing what this thing looks like in real life, you can actually get on YouTube and type in Silver Swan Automaton. And that will give you a 26-second version of the Silver Swan. Is that where you first saw it, on YouTube?
Yeah, I was talking to my very helpful conservator at the Victoria and Albert Museum. She said, there's actually a terrific Silver Swan at the Bose Museum. And I said, where can I get a photograph of this? I'd love to see it. She said, you don't need to do that. Just go on YouTube and type Silver Swan, Bose Museum. This is a woman at the Victoria and Albert telling me to look at YouTube. Anyway, and I did that, and it was so bewitching and beautiful and sinuous and creepy. And so how could I not have that?
Did you look at other automatons?
It's a need to know basis, Richard. So yeah, I did, and as a matter of fact, fantastic New York sculptor, John Kessler, whose work is rather like automatons in a weird way. He and I were going to do an exhibition together, but it fell through. He was going to do the oil spill as an automaton thing. I looked at a few, but really it was the swan I was particularly interested in.
Peter Carey, I have this great quote from you, which is a little bit more of a political quote, but since this is at the origins, or at least let's say the sub-subtext of The Chemistry of Tears, We are living in the 21st century where our industrial growth is overheating the planet to such a degree that it now seems likely to destroy us. Yet all our economic forecasts are seen through the lens of the 19th century. To read the business news, you would think that all growth is good, not lethal.
That was good, I thought. It's sort of nuts, isn't it? I mean, we are in this almost nutty situation where we really do, well, many of us would believe we are already living on the resources of one and a half planets anyway. And that in doing that, we're going to test the system to such a degree that it will break. You cannot force the system beyond. And it doesn't matter what we want or what we cannot do this anymore. But at the same time, we are still in the middle of this sort of particular economic model, which none of us know how to quite escape from. And the basis of which is the good news is last quarter's figures, we had growth. Well, last quarter's figures mean we're even more certain to destroy ourselves. So we do need to find a way somehow to get beyond the notion of growth, because growth is what will kill us. I have always, for years, you know, traveling in airplanes, which I shouldn't be doing, looking down on cities at night, and I'm always reminded, I mean, you have termites and things here in San Francisco. Australia's full of white ants and termites. I look down and I see those glowing little spots, and it seems to me like it's an infestation of termites. And the thing about those things is that they will kill the host eventually. And they're life forms, and they're just doing what they do, but they're going to kill their host. And I think we're going to kill our host, or maybe our host will just kill us, which might be the happiest answer. But we are smart enough, and I mean, this book is about ingenuity. If we really did decide there was a problem, you know, just think of wartime. You know, one day you can't do anything. The next day we're at war. The next day all this stuff is suddenly, you know, it's a whole new thing. You know, we've got to defend our lives. We've got to defend our country. We've got to defend our people. All the methods of manufacture and industry and everything is geared to that. If we decided tomorrow that we really wanted to defend ourselves, we would, I believe, do it. We wouldn't bring back all the species we've destroyed, but we could maybe make sure that our children had lives and their grandchildren.
Have you been back to Sydney since they've had their drought?
I've been to Melbourne since they had their drought, but Melbourne, I don't know as much about the Sydney drought, but in Melbourne, which it was a place I grew up near there, and know a lot about where my brother and sister live in a little town near there, and my family sort of still live around Melbourne. You know, the situation was so seriously bad there that you really thought, well, another 2 years of this city will be uninhabitable. And where people are still, you know, they're already sort of putting in two water systems in their house, you know, one, you know, using rainwater to do this and one from the water from that. They're putting in desalination. And because it's a country which has experienced drought over, historically, drought has been part of the pattern of Australia, and now you can just sort of, if you want to be happy, you can think this is just a really sort of a bad patch we're running through. But it doesn't really look like that, and it's terrifying. I mean, the one thing Australians are continually having to face is that the land that we took really was a land that was inhabited by the indigenous people, and without admitting what we were doing, we stole it, and we fought a war with them, although we didn't admit that, and we took it. And so there's an issue about the land and whose land is it. But by the time we're ready to give it back, maybe no one will be able to live there.
Has the drought ended?
The drought in Melbourne? Yeah. That particular, yes. I mean, they've had some really good rains. My sister's happy. She can actually water the garden with a hose, and the local reservoirs are up, but they're still not full. And this is in wintertime, which is, you know, about this time of year is when the dams are normally, the reservoirs are full. I don't believe they're full yet. And I don't really trust that this is a story that's over.
Peter Carey, what is the story behind the Opera of Bliss?
I had almost nothing to do with it. That's the good part of the story. It's probably why it was successful. I met the composer, Brett Dean, and who I liked immensely, and his music was stranger and weirder than I knew what to do with, but I trusted him. And so I just said, okay, you can do it, and it's yours. And he did it, and he did well, and I can take no credit at all for it. I traveled to Hamburg and Edinburgh and a couple of places in Germany, and it was a sort of a big deal in Australia.
Oscar and Lucinda became a film. Any other novels becoming films?
Well, there is a really interesting conversation going on about the Kelly Gang, which you would think, true history of the Kelly Gang, which you would think could never happen, because there have been more attempts to make films of the Kelly Gang than you could possibly believe. The very first motion picture on the planet Earth was called something about the Kelly Gang, and there are some remains of that, and it was made in Australia. Weird to think that it was not a film made here, but it was true history of the Kelly Gang, or history of the Kelly Gang, or whatever. And then there was a load. There was an awful film directed by Tony Richardson with Mick Jagger in it, which was beyond embarrassment. And then the next thing that I thought was going to happen was that Neil Jordan optioned True History of the Kelly Gang. And he's a director I admire a great deal, and I thought it would have been fabulous to have an Irish director coming to work in Australia, bringing some Irish actors, retying those sort of broken strands of immigration and loss. So just as that seemed about to happen, there'd been another script based on a book by Robert Drew called Our Sunshine. That got up at that moment. And they made the film with Heath Ledger. The film didn't do well, and so the Neil Jordan thing fell through. But now, it looks like it's about to happen with a really talented screenwriter and a really talented director and a great producer. I wasn't at all excited at first, because these things don't normally happen, and it probably won't happen anyway, but it could be very interesting.
Peter Carey, what are you working on now?
I'm working on a novel that's set in Australia between the years of 1943 or 42 and about now. It's got a single narrator, but he's just been found guilty of slander and defamation. He's a journalist, and he's famous for sort of basically, you know, being a little careless about the truth He's hired to write this particular story.
How far into it are you?
Oh, quite a long way. I mean, I don't know. I mean, if you'd asked me this 3 months ago, I would have said I'm 200 pages into it, and it's going quite well. And today I would have to say I'm about 50 pages into it.
Is that what happens? Suddenly you take a break, look at it, and go, got to deconstruct?
Well, I've been driving forward to a particular point, to a central sort of character in a way. And all the things I've been worried about was arriving there. And I got there, I arrived, and I was on the edge of a cliff, because I really hadn't done the work to really know how to go forward. So I had to retreat and rethink and rewrite.
Is that sort of like you get to a certain point and you realize, well, okay, this is where I'm going to go. I have to start doing research. I have to start getting to thinking about where the book is going. And once you begin making those kinds of decisions, suddenly a lot of that, I don't want to say it disappears, but it sort of has to get reconstructed.
Well, you're right. Let's say, you know, that there's a line of travel which I've mapped out that goes A, B, C, D, say. And I've sort of figured it out quite well, and I sort of know pretty much at least a feeling I'm going to end up with. And it's very hard for me to imagine getting from A, B to C, and really all sorts of difficulties. And so I concentrate on getting to C so I can take off to do, say, D and E. And I do that. And I arrive one morning, having arrived there at sea, and I'm on the edge of a cliff because I've been so occupied with the real visceral detail of life of the characters that I'm here, and I haven't really invented enough, I haven't thought enough. And so what I tend to do in those situations is I'm a little slow to realize what's happened to me. And so I'm sort of keeping on writing, but you have this awful feeling that you're faking it, you know, that you've really... And then you say, okay, you've got to go back to the beginning, and you've got to think about it all, and you've got to think about who that person is, who was somebody looming in the future, and you've really got to know who they are and where they come from and what their life is and has been. And they're not just a puppet, they're somebody.
Going on a book tour at that moment in a book, does that kind of bring you out of it sufficiently to be able to do that, or was it just happenstance that it happened kind of right now?
Going on a book tour when you haven't got anything to go back to is awful. You know, that's a case of, is this all there is? You know, I've written this book, and now I've got to go back, and I'm well into the other book, so the book tour just means I can't write, and I'll read and talk to people.
Why did you pick the title, The Chemistry of Tears?
Well, I was very interested in the notion of the body and the body's chemistry, and you know, when people love each other and the skin touches the skin, and you know, the number of sense organs in the skin is incredible. And so you start to think about how all these sort of our emotions are connected to our body. And I thought that when I think about tears, we often ask, why do we cry and what happens? And obviously it's lubrication is why tears are there. But I thought there might be more, and so I did. The title of this book was, in fact, a Google search. With a guess, you know, that if you wanted to look into the chemistry, the biochemistry of tears, the tears are doing all sorts of things. I can no longer remember the names of the chemicals, but one of the chemicals is like an anesthetic that it releases. One of the chemicals gives you a sort of a feeling not dissimilar to having had sex. And one of the, I don't know what the third one
is. It's in the book.
It's all in the book. But it sort of was exactly what I felt it must be, because, and I wanted this joining of the mystery of the joining of our emotions and our strongest feelings and longings with the way the great machine of the body operates.
Well, that's why I thought in the end it was very appropriate, because you're putting together not only what makes us human, but what makes us machines, which comes right back to the themes of the
book.
Which
we find terribly hard to accept. You know, I mean, we really feel that that's somehow an awful thing to think. And for Catherine in the book and for me, it's not an awful thing to think. It's a source of a huge wonder and amazement. And, of course, the book also is an argument against that point of view. I mean, there are two points of view. There's the Catherine's sort of rather rationalist point of view, which is rather like mine. But there is this other point of view which flies very high in the novel, which is we do not know who we are. We cannot know anything. We are like flies buzzing against the glass at the roof of a cathedral. We don't know we're in a cathedral. We don't know what's on the other side of the glass. All we know is we just can't get to the light for some reason. So the book certainly isn't a didactic beast.
You've been listening to an interview with Peter Carey, whose latest novel is The Chemistry of Tears. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.